and I am terribly pleased to welcome back a good friend and someone who has been on this program once before, and we had such a smashing time, I wanted to bring him back and get into some of his continuing research. Michael Tazarian, welcome back.
Rob, nice to be with you. Nice to be back on the show.
Brilliant to have you back, my friend. I've seen you now and again at some of the usual places.
Yep.
And I just thought, well, it's the beginning of 2006. Got to get Michael back on because I know you're working on some incredible stuff. I mean, last time we were on, we talked about the origins of evil, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Yeah, Atlantis and the origins of evil. That's right.
Yep. And it was extraordinary. We got a lot of great feedback. And this time around, we're going to get into some fascinating stuff. We're going to get into some Da Vinci Code type of material. We're going to talk about the Irish origins of mankind.
Yep. Right? Irish origins of civilization.
Of civilization. And we're going to talk about a few other projects you're working on now. But let's talk about Ireland. You're an Irish man.
Yep.
You hail from Belfast.
That's correct.
Great town. I've been there. Drank many a pint there.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. And let's talk, let's give people a little bit of an idea of what's happening on the ground now. We haven't heard much out of Northern Ireland lately. Things have sort of settled down a bit, eh?
They have settled down. Definitely, the, you know, the guns and the army are off the streets. You know, from a political point of view, there has been positive, you know, movements forward in the sense that they haven't given up. And, you know, they do realize that this kind of situation, this third world country, on the back door of England, you know, you're going to have to sort of stop that. It doesn't look good in the eyes of the world. You know, all this screaming and yelling about freedom and diversity for the last 30 years, you know, and then you have this sort of Vietnam on your doorstep. It doesn't look good. So, you know, from that point of view, they've moved forward. And, of course, Thatcher is out of the picture. So, you know, nothing could be as bad as that.
Clearly.
Got to move forward once she's out of the way.
Ugh.
So, you know, substantially there's been some movement forward. But you see, again, you know, my take on it is that, yeah, that's okay for the boardroom. That's okay for the camera eye and for the world stage. But, you know, what about the Irish people who are still living there and have these conflicts? The army out of the way, but what about the violence? You know, the violence and the sectarianism still is quite strong there and is going to take a lot longer to be dealt with. It's not a bad thing. There's reasons for that kind of feeling there. It's just that when you're dealing with human emotion and you're dealing with people, it's not going to be a couple of, you know, guys in a tweed suit on a mahogany table signing a bunch of papers that's going to do the trick. That just, you know, alleviates one layer of problems.
Yeah.
Then you go to the next step down until finally people start to really grasp what these conflicts are about. They start listening to people like ourselves and to find out that, wait a minute, these conflicts might have actually been orchestrated. They're not something that just happened all of a sudden because of some religious schism back in 1690 or what have you.
Yeah, there's a surface explanation to what's going on. There's a surface explanation to what's going on.
Yeah.
But then there's a real explanation.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about some of this manufactured or synthetic terrorism that has woven itself into the conflict in Northern Ireland. There has been reports that the British Secret Service were responsible for some of the bombings and some of the killings?
Sorry, lost you there. Yeah, that's exactly right. There's been even the Omagh bombing situation. You see, this is a very good point that you brought up, because in every instance in which a travesty has happened, say, take 100 atrocities that's taken place, and I don't care if it's the IRA doing it or it's the Protestant paramilitaries doing it, in most cases, the victims, they just accept the official, you know, reports of what has happened. They accept that there's going to be an official investigation and that their children and their families have been killed. And then they believe what they're going to see in the Belfast Telegraph and on the British news, and that's about it. But in the instances, like the Omagh bombing, in instances where the families have not accepted that and then made a little tiny bit of investigation on their own behalf, the whole official, storyline, the spin, goes out the window in minutes.
It really does. It's really paper thin to anybody with a modicum of discerning appreciation.
Isn't it? People have seen In the Name of the Father. Well, that actually happened where, you know, five people were interned for 15 years for crimes that they did not commit. That's a minor situation compared to a lot of other things that have happened. People who are not familiar with this thesis, they just go and rent the movie Oma. It's actually made by the people who were involved in the Oma bombing. It's an in-your-face, very, very gritty movie showing you that when this small group of ordinary people, and it's very important to realize the power of the ordinary person, that when they got into investigating, and remember, these are completely, you know, Protestant people who believe, oh my goodness, no, the government would never lie to us, the police are our best friends, we're just going to overlook their reports, we're just going to find out what kind of files they kept. By the end of their investigation, they knew who the enemy was, and believe me, it wasn't the IRA. So, you know, they were vetoed from day one. Yeah. I'm not exonerating the IRA, I'm not a spokesman for them, but I'm just saying that there is an entire matrix of control that both sides are not aware of. It goes into the Orange Lodge in Ireland, control the Protestant mindset. These are people who feathered their own nests, who don't give a damn about their ordinary people, who are interested in keeping chaos in the streets because they're connected to Masonic orders who keep chaos throughout the world. There's a branch of the Masonic order very powerful in Northern Ireland, which is colloquially known as the Orange Lodge. But behind them is the Black Preceptory, you know, and behind them is yet again the Illuminati. So we have a situation like that. In the south, it's exactly the same order. The exact same Masonic order controls the southern Republican movements, only the Masonic order down there is called the Ancient Order of Hibernians. It would be called the Green Ribbon. So when everybody sees Gerry Adams wearing that nice little green ribbon, it looks like the little AIDS ribbon, they go, oh, marvelous, it's the green for Ireland. No, buddy, go and do your homework and you'll find out that the Green Ribbon is the Green Ribbon Lodge. It's a version, an Irish version of the Ancient Order of Hibernians that goes back to the Masonic lodges that, with the other hand, the left hand, because as Yuri Lina, the great scholar in Secret Society, said, when in Freemasonry, when the Freemason right-hand brother has finished, his left-hand brother takes over. So we have a situation in Ireland that is an exact duplicate of this divide-and-conquer Novus Ordo Seclorum, Ordo Ab Caeo type of situation in which the green... Look at the flag. The flag tells you it right there. The flag is the symbolic whole story. The green on one side, the orange on the other, the gold, and in the middle, the white. Does anybody ever bother asking who are the whites? Who are the illuminated white brotherhood who are controlling the sides of polarity there? This information has been touched upon by some of these families who've tried to investigate unsuccessfully atrocities that have happened to them and then come up against it. Back in the 1970s, Rob, there was a very fine movie that touched on this called, it just slipped my mind. It'll come to me in a minute. It was a very Enemy of the State. It wasn't Enemy of the State, but it was a something deception, and it was a very, very brilliant movie on Ireland that literally showed this, that they literally, the characters were acting as if they were aristocratic, Masonic-type people.
Really?
Who were instructing this ordinary journalist into how the game is played.
Wow.
Yeah, the movie, it'll come to me. It's a very well-known film.
Okay, and that'll pop up later in the show.
Yeah,
well,
and we'll get to
this,
it.
This is extraordinary because you and I both agree, and many others, that the British military are behind some of these orchestrated synthetic terrorist events.
It's not the British military. They're just given orders. Behind them is Special Branch.
Special Branch
is MI5. Behind MI5 is the elite, you know, Knights Templar organizations from London, from St. John, from the Court of St. James.
Right.
And these characters give orders that the MI5 carry out. Now, the MI5 lower-level people and the British Army and even some of the Special Branch, they think that they're doing good, that they're just saving England and that they're doing, you know, a good day's work of reconnaissance and surveillance. It's only their commanders who are laughing and who know the truth. For instance, a lot of people, everyone in the world can say, if you ask them a question, hey, what is the famous paramilitary organization that has been going for the last 60 years in Ireland and they're Republican? Everybody goes, the IRA. And then you say, okay, what does that stand for? They go, Irish Republican Army. You go, okay, from what order did they originate? Complete silence. Even in Ireland, you'll get stum. Okay, the IRA, just open any encyclopedia, go on online, probably even to wikipedia.org, go on to any online or pick up any dictionary that matters, and look up in the IRA, and it'll say that the IRA came out of an order called the Irish Republican Brotherhood. That's what the IRA were before they were called the Army. They had to change it to a political title because you can't, in the 19th century, anyone knew that if you said the word brotherhood, that you were a secret society. Now, coming into the 20th century and after the First and Second World War, they decided to change that because it obviously looked that this was then an occult battle between legions of the secret societies openly working in the world. So when you see Gerry Adams wearing the green ribbon, he is still in the know that it's not a political action, it is a secret society action, of which he is just one pawn on the board.
I mean,
Sinn Féin's symbol, which has been staring people in front of their eyes for years, is the dove. Now, if that doesn't open a ball of wax, I don't know what does.
So,
the dove is the most ancient symbol of the secret societies, especially the Knights of Columbus, because the Spanish and Latinesque word for dove is colum. So the Knights of Colum, it's the same dove you see on the maces of the British Queen. It's one of the. It's on the Visa credit cards, for goodness sake. Greenpeace use it. It does not represent the Holy Spirit, which is what a lot of people think. What on earth would Sinn Féin be doing with the symbol of the Holy Spirit? I mean, that's troublesome enough, even if it was that symbol, because then it would tie them into the Jesuits and to the Catholic Church. But that's not the reason why they're doing it. Why then do they choose this biblical symbol from the Noah? You know, we got to ask some questions. But people who have done their homework, who have studied the alternative history of the world, who've listened to individuals like us, will know that the dove is the symbol of the Knights of Columbus, a super secret body of elite, non-local individuals who rule in America, who rule Britain, who come out of Venice, who are very much got into power during the time of the Protestant leader, William I, at the Battle of the Boyne back in 1690. These individuals are the ones using the symbolism. Sinn Féin is but a wing of secret societies. The Orange Order is a wing of the secret societies. People are dying in the streets in England just like they're dying in South Africa, like they're dying all over the world, like they have been dying in the regimes of Pol Pot. Or you can't name a situation like they're dying now in Russia, how they covered up all of that stuff that happened in Georgia with the massacre of all of those children, the ritual sacrifices of these kids, and a couple of, you know, news programs, and then it's all forgotten. People don't understand that these organizations are secret. They are based on, they have secret society connections. You know, every child goes to school, Rob, as you know, and learns that it was the shooting of Archduke Ferdinand that started the First World War.
We read that.
You know, the assassination of him and his wife by this crank in Austria started the First World War. What they don't tell you is that when that assassin shot the king, he raised up his right hand and said, "And this is done in the name of the Black Hand,"
yeah,
which is a known Illuminati enclave. On top of that, they don't tell you that at exactly that moment, and I don't mean exactly that hour, I mean exactly that moment, two other kings were shot in the world by assassins from the same group. The King of Spain was shot on the same moment, assassinated by the same Black Hand, and in Sweden, Gustav III, one of the greatest monarchs that we've actually ever known in the world, a brilliant man who designed Stockholm, was shot on stage while he was in the middle of a play. Assassins came on stage and shot him through the head and killed Gustav III, that all Swedes know is one of their greatest kings, and also said, "This is done this moment under the Black Hand." And all the newspapers in those days carried the fact that it was secret society, Illuminati, uprisers, iconoclasts who were doing this. Today we look back and we just have that one anecdote so that people do not see the connections. If you just say one guy was killed, they just think, oh, what a tragedy. But what would the world think if they knew that even in those days it was an orchestrated thing, and start reading up on it, you see? So we are being told so many lies about the conflicts that exist in our world.
Well, it's funny because we have a microcosm at work. We have the secret societies and their public proactive wings or their organizations, which, of course, is, you know, as you say, Sinn Féin and others. And it's unfolding very much like the large scale wars did. But this is happening in Northern Ireland, has been on a much sort of smaller scale. It's almost like it's like a test area.
It is. And, you know, that's why my work exists, is because by having it done in a microcosm is one of the reasons I got into the bigger picture. Because I didn't get into all the sectarian stuff myself, even though everyone I know is involved. But I started to see behind the veil. I mean, that's a long story, but I started to see behind the veil of what was going on. And because it was in microcosm, and because I start to see the unsustainability of the different groups to which, you know, my people were involved, and, of course, all my friends, whether it was the communist, extreme left, Marxists, who I all know, whether it was Sinn Féin, whether it was members of the IRA, where it was, you know, and you can't live in Belfast and not know the whole cross-section. But then I start to see that they're limited. Their knowledge about what is going on is either wrong or incredibly limited, or more important than this is what we find now in today's world, it is self-aggrandizing. Today, it is of no consequence to anybody what happened in 1690. The Catholics couldn't care less about that. What they want to do is worry about protection rackets in Belfast and how much money they're going to make. Mm-hmm. And on the Protestant side, it's about, yeah, how come the euro dollar is going to knock on the door? Maybe we can get into the middle class now by keeping the conflict going. It's the same rhetoric that's been going on in Dublin with all the protection rackets and drug trade down there under the guise of politics and terrorism. Now, you're going to have a Dublin 2 in Belfast if something doesn't. If people don't look to this,
you take terrorism
off the streets,
yeah.
And you get this other machination coming in about self-servingness.
Yeah,
you know. In the earlier days, you're absolutely right. It was about the conflict control. It's a microcosm.
It is.
In their own backyard can see a microcosm of what's going on in the rest of the world.
It's almost as if it's a test case for a larger plan that is yet to unfold on a larger scale, say in major cities like London and Europe and America. They've taken these and occupied these towns in a European country, and they draw upon people's knee-jerk reactions, their affiliations, their religions. They draw upon what they know they can draw upon.
Well said.
As a larger test case yet to come, perhaps.
Well said. Dealing with people's emotions has been, let's even say, if we go back to our topic about the Nephilim and the Anunnaki and the world controllers and all of that, and the alien presence. My goodness, people have asked me so many times, how did this intricate labyrinth get created? You just put it into a nutshell. They are able to control, like puppets on a string, our emotions. We can't use our reason. We don't use our objectivity. We don't see what's going on because these individuals know how to light a fire under us. They know how to create these faux oppositions. They know how to create these fake religions. They know how to create a lot of these things that will give us emotional security because we're so damn empty existentially and spiritually. And we're not turned on by something really true. So then they hand us these collectivized, consensus, trance kinds of things, these roles, basically, as the psychologists have always said. The role of the mother, the role of the father, the role of the brother, the role of the politician, the role of the boss. And we're all in these bloody roles. And then if these roles get challenged in any way, well, then we're challenged. The human being is challenged. And now he's got enemies. Now he's going to fight you. In fact, no, he's going to buy a gun and kill you. And he's going to start waving this flag, if that is what helps. He's going to gang up in a herd-like mentality with others of his kind. And this is the way that the game is played. And the guys in control, are dancing on their desks with glee as to how easy it has been.
Because you know what?
In their wildest dreams, they didn't think it was going to be as easy.
Yeah, that's how the game is played. But I think this little occupation that has been going on was a test case for doing the same game in a different environment. They wanted to see how it would work in a populated area. They wanted to see how it would work on Anglo-Saxons. They wanted to see how it would work in a Western context. As I say, maybe for a test case for a larger scale model that's about to unfold. But, I'm interested in this stuff as well. When I was in Londonderry a few years ago walking around, I saw these symbols and I started to realize that there is a Masonic connection to all this. I was walking around and looking at the murals and just having a bit of a gander and taking it all in. I saw the flag of Israel flying around everywhere. And I even picked up some Masonic paraphernalia and at a store that was right next to, say, the dry cleaners.
Right.
So to have this sort of availability, it started to raise these questions in my mind. Now, I'll ask you what I asked you just off the air a few moments ago. Why in Londonderry do people see and do they fly the flag of Israel?
Right. Well, see, this is a beautiful point. And that's how I started my own research as well. Because I kept going around asking these kinds of questions to people who were in these roles, and they didn't have an answer. Of course, they have an answer.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. They'll give you an earful. But, then you cross-reference that, and suddenly it doesn't make any sense. So after years of researching this very topic about the symbolism in the murals, about the symbols that are employed, say, for instance, in the 12th of July Orange Parades. In fact, the date that it even happens on the 12th of July, that's extremely significant, very close to the summer solstice, etc., etc. And then what happens is you start to get into this entire world of occultism. That Star of David and those Judaic symbols that are shown there have nothing to do with the State of Israel at all.
Yet it's Israel's flag.
Ah, because Israel is doing the same thing as the Orange Order are.
Ah.
The symbols don't belong to Israel. The symbols are Masonic in nature and astromantic and have a very ancient history going back to the Druids and to a lot of other esoterical cult stuff that it just happens that other countries, either ignorantly or consciously, are employing.
Well, you know what? The flag of Israel, the Star of David, really was the seal of Solomon.
Right. So, and then before that, it becomes, you know, it was used by the Brahmins. We see the five-pointed pentagram on the communist flag. We see a sickle, which is a druidic sickle, on the old communist flag. We see the old gavel, the hammer of the Masons. Not the shipyard. That is a very specific hammer of the Masonic Lodge on the communist flag, on a red background. The Star of David is a case in point, as you just said. The American dollar bill. You know, all over the world you find these symbols. My God, these Eastern countries, a mere study of the flags and regalia and heraldry of the Eastern Bloc countries, this is post the communist takeover, will astound people at the amount of hammers and sickles and compasses and Masonic paraphernalia and stars and rising suns and all of this kind of thing that people like Jordan Maxwell have totally studied and gone into. I started to see this in an Irish context in exactly the same way. I mean, what on earth is this star of Sirius doing over this character's head, Killamuro? Somebody is telling us something here. And, of course, if you ever go to the Orange Parade, then you're really going to see it, because even the marches that these people do are geomantically placed.
Really?
Is that they go, oh, yeah, the timing. It's the same thing in the laying of the stones of Washington, D.C. The very moment that the stone of a foundation building or an obelisk is even put into the ground, it is significant. They don't even drop the stone until it's 333, you see, or, you know, some sort of Masonic symbol or number.
Yeah.
They're all encoded to them. So I started to notice that there is no connection to Israel. Then what's going on here? What's that symbol about? And then they kind of give you that insider smile, which implies that, hey, chump, you don't know, but we have these ritualistic sun symbols, symbols of the ancient times before any state, before any nation even thought of getting organized, thousands of years before there was even such a thing as Israel or the IRA or whoever. These symbols were used in the great Druidic colleges of old and were known to the elite orders, the intelligentsia, the colleges like Alexandria and others that existed in the world. And as far away as India and Benares is in Japan, they haven't been digging up all these blonde, red-haired tribes out there in the middle of Japan that everyone for hundreds of years said, of course, the Aryan race never got as far as the East. And then they're digging them up, wearing tartan, and their women are wearing Bronze Age Nordic costume. Yeah, so there, out the window goes all of those hundreds of years of lies. You see? So we have a situation here of an old world and a new world, and some of the symbolism from the old world is still carrying over, like the dove that I was mentioning earlier, and like this Star of David and so many of the other symbols. One has to, you know, here's the thing. Even though it's a little bit out of the bag now in Ireland in a context of Protestant cities where you kind of do see this paraphernalia, isn't it amazing how many documentaries, Rob, and how many books have been written? I mean, to this day, you can go into the bestseller table and see books on the IRA and the Republican movement, big, thick hardbacks. When is the last time you've ever seen a book on the bestseller list or a book at all about the Orange Order?
Yeah, really?
In public, I mean, you, of course you can get them in some dusty library, but what about on the shelves? It's IRA this, it's Republican this, it's here, look, Martin McGuinness's, you know, biography.
Yep.
Tell us all about Sinn Féin and the nationalist community.
Yep.
And yet, conspicuously, there's been hardly any information in the public.
Yeah, because there's this elaborate play.
Orange Order.
There's this elaborate play going on that is enough to fill books. It's enough to fill lives. It's enough to fill the minds of all the people who take part in this play and all the people who are observing it.
That's right.
Yeah, and they filled it out so much. But, you know, the Orange Lodge is made up of who? Do we have any faces that we can attach to this organization?
That's not my speciality, but I'll tell you where you can go. I've been working with a great friend in Ireland who has made his life study of this.
Oh.
And his book is featured on my website. If you go to taroscopes.com, which is my site, and go into the links page, you will find that there is a link there that takes you to what's called the Affiliates Products page.
Okay.
Okay, so it's, you go to my website, you go to the links page.
Right.
Just to my regular link.
Got it. Affiliates Products page.
The Affiliates page. And on that, the first book is one of the most remarkable books that I believe has ever been written.
What's it called?
By a character from Belfast who's been a great friend for years. He's actually the man who opened the very first metaphysical bookstore in Ireland.
Wow.
In Belfast. I mean, it's history. You know, it didn't last long.
Yeah.
It was in the 80s. given the kind of mentality that unfortunately was predominant there. But he's down on record as doing that. Now, his life story has been, to answer the question you just asked, which is, who are the faces? What is the Orange Order? And the book is called Ireland, Land of the Pharaohs.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's by Andrew Powers. Okay. And if you go to my website, to that page, you'll see links. Also, you can click on them, and it will take you to interviews, live interviews he did in Ireland, advertising his book. He also is an expert on the Matrix movie, decoding the symbolism of the Matrix. But I want people to get his book, because it was a book that was dedicated to me, because, you know, and to Jordan Maxwell, which was just lovely.
Good heavens.
But what this man has done is phenomenal, and it is one of the first books to take off the cover of The Secrets of Ireland. The Secrets of Northern Ireland, what has been what the troubles are. He does talk about the ancient Atlanteans as well. There's not a stone that the guy doesn't, you know, he doesn't overturn and cover.
So, you
know what his speciality is?
Yeah.
His speciality is the occult significance of the Battle of the Boyne.
Okay.
Because this man found out that there wasn't there was nobody ever killed at the Battle of the Boyne? They haven't fired a single bullet or rifle. Now, after a battle scene all over the world, and anyone with a, what do you call those things? Anybody with one of those metal detectors will tell you this, that they love doing this because it's their hobby, to head out to a place where there's a big battle and, of course, find all the relics and the belt buckles, you see, and the buttons with
a metal detector. Yeah.
Do you know that in the famous Battle of the Boyne that is known all over the world, there's not a single, nobody has even found more than one pellet? Because the entire thing was a staged Masonic ritual so that the power could hand over from the Stuart dynasty, which is just one more ancient Atlantean bloodline, but handing over to their cousins, the Hanoveran dynasty, from which the Windsor family comes. And this thing was done ritualistically, en masse, down there near Newgrange Tomb, which everyone who's into metaphysics, into Irish history knows that Newgrange is where the Battle of the Boyne was fought, near this ancient, ancient tomb.
Yeah.
And it was done ritualistically. And more than that, the very moment that the King's Horse, this is a famous image of, you've seen those murals yourself, Rob, where, you know, the white horse of King William is moving into the water of the Boyne.
Yes.
And he's got a sword above the horse's head. That moment that he did that, the sun was moving across the Milky Way, which is known to be the river in the sky, right? They say that the Boyne at that point, the River Boyne at that point makes almost exactly the contours of the Milky Way. This is another strange thing. It's like what Graham Hancock has discovered in the Far East at Agora, and also what him and Robert Bouval found about in the layout of the pyramids being shaped to look like the Belt of Orion.
Right.
Well, the same thing was happening in Ireland regarding the River Boyne and its positioning and the war that took, the battle that took place there. He says that when you step back from the mural that looks like the king with a sword across the horse's head between the ears of the horse, and it looks like a unicorn. And it turns out that that's what the white horse was, because actually the horse that he rode in the battle was black. So why then did they show a white horse? Because the white horse, or unicorn, and the red lion of Leo are the constellations that were in the sky at exactly the moment of the commencement of the Battle of the Boyne. People need to get this book to discover the kind of occult symbolism that has been used on the human race that empowers these individuals, that comes out of the ancient Druidic past, that they used to empower themselves. Because yes, you do have Masonic orders, and yes, you do have these secret societies, but what do they do? What is the purpose? People are pretty vague about that. The fact of the matter is this, that when the Roman armies conquered Ireland, when the Roman Catholic Church continued the process with their puppet British kings to oppress and destroy and annihilate the Druidic tradition and to suppress the Irish, you don't just burn libraries and take books and take all this knowledge and throw it down. That's what history would love you to believe. But, you see, what they do is they sequester that knowledge. They know that that knowledge is very powerful. So they tell you that the Druids are all pagans and need to be burned and, you know, annihilated. But what they don't tell history is that that knowledge of the Druids, their knowledge of herbalism, their knowledge of astronomy, their knowledge of the great journey of enlightenment, all of the things that they taught have been appropriated, and the Masonic lodges of the world are the keepers of that knowledge. That's what they are. They are archivists. Half of them don't even know what they're archiving. But they don't need to know. It's a fraternity cell-structured system in which it is to preserve. One of their jobs, one of their major jobs, is to preserve the knowledge that is stolen, pillaged from the great races that then are annihilated from the face of the earth. Because the understanding is that, yes, you can kill and annihilate these Druids, these Phoenicians, these Philistines, these Hellenes, you know, oh my God, the list goes on, the Egyptians, all the great races of the world can be annihilated from the earth, but their knowledge cannot be annihilated. That knowledge must continue to empower the modern leaders of the world. And the people to keep that knowledge, like sort of librarians, so to speak, are the Masonic orders of the world. And that is why, specifically, the Masonic order incorporates so many Irish symbols and also Egyptian symbols, like the pyramid. When people look at the dollar bill in America, for instance, they obviously see the Egyptian symbolism there. That's been pointed out by many scholars now.
Yeah.
It's almost like a cliche.
Yeah.
But what they don't understand is that there's a lot of Druidic symbolism on there as well, because there was an ancient connection between the Irish Druids and the Egyptians. And this is what I go into in my forthcoming book that will be coming out in the summer, called The Irish Origins of Civilization. And this
right.
will go into these ancient connections. Andrew Power's book is already out, and I tell people to get this because it's a fantastic look into the occult history of Ireland. And he and I follow in the tradition of a man that's remarkable, that people should know about, called Conor McDarry. Conor McDarry lived at the turn of the century and was the first man to say one remarkable thing. And if I say it on your show right now, you might even be making radio history, because this has been so suppressed for years. And that is this. McDarry and Commons Beaumont, again, these great maverick scholars, were the first people to go against one of the most major taboo areas that we're taught. In life, we are taught three taboo areas. One is that you never inquire into the prehistory of the world, right? Basically, when you go to history school, or you study history, or you pick up a book, history is, they say that history starts from about 7 to 10,000 years ago. That's when the wheel was made, that's when basket making came on the picture, that's when the, you know, the alphabet was created, and you don't think about anything else before that. Now, of course, Graham Hancock and others have shot that to pieces. Michael Cremo and so many scholars have said, look, you must be kidding. You know, and my first book, Atlantis, deals also in that, that wait a minute, we're going to break through that taboo. Of course there were civilizations in ancient times. But then there's a second taboo. Yeah, so the second taboo is that you never question religion. Now, everyone knows that one, so we don't need to elaborate on it. It's but the thing is that there is a third taboo that people may not be fully aware of, and that is that people are not ever meant to question that civilization spread from the east to the west. This is, you know, again, like as soon as I believe that on this show and on other shows I intend to do, that this actually will make radio history, because it is an old theme that has been very, very craftily suppressed for a long, long time. So I'll restate it again. In life, we are always taught in school, and it's a major consensus. It's such a consensus that even most of the academic scholars and historians also, on every show on TV that you will see, without fail, no matter how good they are in other ways, will always be underwriting the theory, and it's a false theory, that civilization spread from the east to the west. That means from the Middle East, from Asia Minor, from the Levant, and then spread westwards. Now, this is a preposterous theory, and even though it answers, well, you know, some particular anomalies about our world and our history, it has the habit of leaving many, many other questions unanswered. These are the stumbling blocks that then other historians have to come along and, you know, re-attack. And yet we still don't seem to have the right answer. What would happen if we turned that around? And this is exactly what Conor McDarry and Commons Beaumont and a lady by the name of Anna Wilkes in the 1800s, they did. These are the three scholars of the past who decided to turn it around in their mind and say, what would happen if, as the ancient legends are saying, civilization spread from the west to the east, and more specifically, from Ireland and England, from Britain, into the west?
Imagine that.
Yeah. Now, what happens indeed? What happens is their work gets suppressed. They wrote some fine books on it, but then their work gets suppressed. Here we are again, and Andrew and myself are following in the path. I very much have dedicated my work even physically to Commons Beaumont and to Conor McDarry, and I am very, very conscious that I'm in their footsteps, because I have found incredible information. So anyone out there who's listening to us, who's interested in the true origins of civilization, who has made a study of this and found it difficult to accept what we've been told about the Phoenicians and the Egyptians and the Indians and how all of this came about, they need to turn their head around. They need to make the job a lot easier for themselves by switching the whole picture, because you've been told a pack of lies by people who know that the lie is unsustainable. The lie was nearly shut down during the rise of the anthropologists and antiquarians during the German Reich. Remember that, you know, the Nazi German Reich period?
Sure.
Where there was an awful lot of interest in the origins of civilization.
These characters
nearly hit on the truth, except they also, by being controlled by secret societies, bent it out of shape.
Well, okay, so what you're saying is they were on a quest to explore the origins of the Aryan race.
Yes.
And they were looking in places...
But they did it by, in a way...
Well, they were looking in places like Tibet and Egypt.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So in other words, they were doing the same problem, but even more than that, they did something even more deadly. And that's a whole story of why they might have done that, is because I think they were under control to hide this topic. But that's a whole other story. What they also did, the mistake was, that they were trying to have you think of the Aryans as a race, when in fact it's not so much like a race, it's more like a hierarchy of a particular race. Meaning, specifically, the way that Conor McDarry and others would put it, is that in any race, the elite, the people who go towards the path of enlightenment, has nothing to do with politics, but it's those who seek after truth, are the Aryans. Because the word Arya never really ever represented any race. It was specifically about a kind of ennobled one. It actually meant the ones who are ennobled. And that meant from any race who starts to question the big meta questions of the world and who seeks out the teachers of that knowledge and who then eventually becomes a teacher in that way. When a man of enlightenment, whether he was a Brahmin or from China or from Japan or Russian, you know, chose that kind of lifestyle, he was known in ancient times as one of the Arya, meaning the enlightened one or the shining one, okay? Now, this was bent out of shape because, of course, in the 19th century, they wanted you to believe it was a specific race, and then, of course, they, you know, it kind of disproved itself. But the thing is this, just for now, people need to get their heads around the idea of the Western origins of civilization, which ties in perfectly to those who have been working in the field of Atlantis. Because, look, it's simple, isn't it? If Atlantis was destroyed in the Atlantic Ocean area, which we know that it was, this has even been accepted by the top scholars of Oxford and Cambridge University, that sunken islands did exist out in the Atlantic Ocean. Okay, then the survivors of those sunken cities would have only a couple of choices, right? They're either going to go east, westward towards Mexico, and that's what the Maya and the Aztec are always telling you, that their ancestors came from ruined, fallen, devastated cities in the west, meaning out on the Atlantic Ocean. And the other option is to travel west to what are now known as England and Ireland. In ancient mythology, England and Ireland are always known as the Blessed or the Fortunate Isles. You know, everyone's even heard of the Luck of the Irish, right? This comes from the fact that the Blessed or Fortunate Isles are called that because of they were survivors of the great cataclysms and pole shifts that, again, the academica don't want you to know about.
You know what else is interesting? To think that the existing currents, if they were even close to what they were back then, would have naturally brought them toward the direction of Scotland and Ireland.
Yeah. And then there's a whole school of people who believe that there wasn't as much water then, so they might have even been able to walk to some parts of it. But in any case, as the ancient legends of Ireland tell you, it's not that this is somebody making this up. The legends are telling you in the ancient annals and the ancient scriptures that they arrived on Ireland and England, which was their salvation. And it is from re-erecting these old, what are now called the Druidic colleges. Because the remnants of the Atlantean, Lemurian, I remember there was four other continents as well of enlightened peoples in those days, of the old hybrids. So when these individuals congregated, and it's not only that they congregated in England and Ireland, of course there was groups all throughout, scattered throughout the world from these enormous cataclysms. But it seems to have happened that the ones with some very, very great knowledge, some very illustrious types from the ancient world, re-congregated in Ireland and England, and from that time on, that country has been a temple without walls. It's known geomantically to be a very powerful vortex area, and nobody can study its history. The bardic, poetic tradition, if you study that, you find it's the highest poetry in the world, unsurpassed. You go to the minstrel tradition and study the compositions of the music and the whole phenomenology of the harp, and it's miles beyond all of these other twangers in other parts of the world, the kind of sophistication that you had in the music. So we got something here that we need to uncover, which is the Irish origins of civilization. Now, here's the interesting thing. One of the biggest ways that this and other subjects have been covered up is in the misuse of words, the mistranslation of words, the adding of vowels where they don't belong, the interchange of certain consonants, and also the adding of consonants that didn't exist in the Gaelic language, for instance.
Really?
In truth, the word Irish is not Irish at all. It is Irish. The I was put in the place of an A. The A was used because it's a sacred letter, etc., etc. But it was actually Irish, A-R-I-S-H. That's one of the words for the ancient peoples. And that is where you get the word root Ari, or the Aryan. So the Aryan people, right? We're the Irish. Again, not so much a race. Let's not think of that. Let's think of a scholastic branch, a very highly adept spiritual college of the Arya that was known throughout the world. These Aryan Druids, they could see, I mean, you can see England from Ireland, and you can see Europe from England. So obviously they knew that other lands were out there after the cataclysms, and it is then subsequently down through the thousands of years that they sent their British and Briton, the word in those days was Briton, B-R-I-T-O-N, which implied Celtic. The Celtic race spread out from the west to the east. Now, I know this is going to do a lot of table turning for people, but they not need to at least take on board the facts. And if they go to my website, the book will be ready in late summer, but I've got a lot of information on this on my website and Taroscopes, and if they get on the Taroscopes and just go to the astrotheology pages, they will then find the whole story laid out. Because interestingly, even though this book is about Ireland, it also is about 50% about Egypt, and also about the Christian church and the rise of Christianity. Because the reason why you and I are talking about this today, and the reason why this is not known today, is because of the adversarial agencies who did not want this knowledge to be known to the world.
So about what time did this initial spread from Ireland begin to work its way east?
I think it happened after the worst of the cataclysms was over, and that was about 13,000 years ago. Between 13,000 and 11,000 years ago is when the cataclysm faded, and that there was some semblance of normality returned. And it wasn't much of a semblance, I can tell you that, because as people have read my first book know, it was an absolutely horrendous situation. We were dealing with a pole shift on the back of a flood. The flood had happened 50,000 years ago, and then we had it 13,500 years ago, approximately, we had an actual polar shift situation, which was utterly devastating. It's in the years subsequent to that that the Earth gains a semblance of normality, that the countries take on the look that they have, that the oceans are first, of course, they may have come through the flood, but certainly there's more water because the Earth polar shift also attracted a lot more debris from the planet Tiamat that was out there. So the pole shift subsided around 14,000 years ago.
Okay.
This has now been proven by aging of the Sphinx, the water levels there, and also by geological record.
Okay, so
I'm talking
when
about the top of the academic totem pole.
Okay, so when this original race, the remnants of Atlantis,
yeah,
started to work their way, was there already civilizations in northern Africa?
That's an interesting point. There's two schools. One school believes that there was an aboriginal race originally on Ireland, and they are a most interesting race, actually. And this is one of the things that got me interested in it in the first place, because the aboriginal race, or let's say the descriptions of those aboriginal people that lived on Ireland before these Gaels and Celts got there, are extremely interesting, because they talk about hybridization. They talk about these people being half animal, half human, basically demonic in aspect, with tremendous powers, who dominated Ireland in a sort of a cruel way. And they were called the Fomorian race, with an F, Fomorian race, Fomori.
Well, so I'm clear, who talks about this?
All the legends, all the scholars, Charles Squire, Valency, any of the people that, you know, talk about what's called the mythological cycle of Ireland.
Okay.
I have to find books, you know, because most history books on Ireland will talk about what? The rise of St. Patrick and the Christian Church. You've got to go before that.
Yeah.
Anyone who's talking about the mythological cycle will sometimes talk about the original inhabitants who were meant to be called the Fomorians.
Okay.
But even the Fomorians are meant to not be based on Ireland. They're actually seafarers who actually were people who were on the coast of Scandinavia, where the records of them exist as well. In Scandinavia, they were called the people of Lochlann. Okay? So they're like a sort of a Tolkienite type of people who lived on the ocean, who are known to have lived on the oceans and the seas, but also frequented in somewhat the same way as pirates. In later ages.
And it sounds like they had a pretty good empire. They were over northern Europe or even beyond?
No, just the records of the Fomorian specifically only stretch as far as Scandinavia.
Okay.
You know, and that's where their records end. But their greatest legends come from Ireland. And it's very interesting that you should bring them up, because you know the whole idea of Lucifer, Satan, being also very good looking? Remember the story of before Lucifer, before he fell, right, was meant to be God's favorite. He was the most beautiful angel of all, a radiant complexion. That's even biblical. It turns out that may actually have its origins in the Irish legends, because the kings of the Fomori, even though the Fomori were a pretty hideous hybrid warrior class of people, the legends say that their leaders were beautiful. Very, very handsome men, the most beautiful men in the world. So much so, in fact, that the second king of the Fomorrhi, his name, Bray, is the Celtic word for beautiful.
Wow.
So there's all these sorts of weird, you know, anomalies. But it turns out that, yes, there may have been a group there, and it leads a lot to my theory about the hybridization of ancient people, because these individuals' descriptions are clearly hybrid. And they're described like that. They're
hybrid,
the original
Cyclops. But what, hybrid between what?
Animal and human.
Animal and human?
Mm-hmm. People can go and read my book on it. Or
with
they can,
with a animal and human with a demonic twist?
Yeah. And what I believe is that that's just later renditions of something that the later historians didn't understand. What these poor Fomorrhi probably were the original experiments of these Atlantean visitors that I talk about in my first book. Because these guys didn't just make, you know, the beautiful Homo Atlantis that, you know, I talk about in the book that we're all descended from. You know, the son of the serpent. For brevity's sake, in my presentations and also in the book, you know, we talk only about them. But you see, how do we know that that was not, you know, like a, you know, Mark 15 of their original experiments here, man?
Yeah, that's true. Now, so this race now is encountered, this hybrid race, and what happens? Are they warring?
Yeah, they warred like hell. It was really difficult. In fact, the wars went on down even when subsequent races came. Most races who came to Ireland, there was four waves of what they call the Great Invasions. And it's a book of invasions. People who are really into the true chronicles of this need to get a book called the Liber Gabala and the Book of Invasions. These are old Irish texts that are just two of many that talk about this. And yeah, there were subsequent wars with the Fomorians who just didn't go away.
Okay.
And there's some amazing Tolkien-esque kind of descriptions from the ancient legends, like King Mark of the Fomorians had a tower made of glass. This is where Tolkien picked up his Barad-dûr, you know, the Tower of the Dark Lord. It's from Celtic mythology that he got this, because on Tory Island, which is a small island that still exists off the north of Ireland,
yeah,
they say that King Mark, now listen to this, this is the ancient legend saying this, not me. They say that he had a tower made of glass.
Okay.
And at the top of the tower, he had a seeing stone or a seeing crystal by which he could overlook the whole of Ireland and find out what all the slaves were doing.
Bloody
hell. Where have we seen that one before?
Oh, right. Yeah, the eye in the...
Yeah. Tolkien picked this up because he was an expert in the old Anglo-Saxon books and stuff like that.
In Mordor.
Now, check this out.
Yeah.
In one of the battles that you're talking about, the Sun King of the Gaels, who's called Lu, and the Welsh know him as also Lu,
okay,
and the Latin knew him as Lugos. That's where we get the word Logos from. Lu, the young boy king, he was actually the second in command from the real king of the Gaels, but he went out to battle, and guess what he did? He went out to fight one of the great giant of the Fomorians, who was called Balor. And in the story, this is 5,000 years B.C. This is thousands of years before the Israelites even, you know, came on the page of history. The young boy king is meant to have ridden out on his horse to fight the great giant Balor, and his weapon was a sling. And he kills the Balor of the evil eye with a sling.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's Irish, and it's years before. And many of the legends that were picked up later are plagiarizations of original Celtic Druidic stories, and that's only one of them. The symbol of King David playing his harp, well, believe it or not, that harp is the Druidic harp. These are plagiarized stories of later myth-mongering priest-archies of Catholicism who had risen up from the Vatican and come to Ireland to destroy them. Just like Zamoraga did in Mexico, burning all those books, what do you think St. Patrick and his coterie were doing when they were sent by the Christian Church under Roman auspices to Ireland? They were burning whole libraries. They don't tell you that they were burning libraries, they were burning people, that the Romans came with sword in hand, this wonderful Roman Empire that we're all told about is so bloody wonderful. These were the butchers of the age who rose up under edicts of the great emperors to come to Ireland to annihilate every single Druid and all of their people, because they knew that the exploitatory Leviathan that we know today as Judeo-Christianity could not rule supreme in this world if the pure, unadulterated teachings of the Druids and their colleges, which were worldwide, and I can prove that, existed. So they sent to Gaul, to France, to Spain, to all the countries in which the Druids had set up their colleges, including Italy. Pythagoras' college was opened by a Druid. That's known.
Wow.
Anyone who's an expert in Pythagoras knows 100% true that Pythagoras was inspired by a Druid from Ireland called Abaris. It's where we get the word rabbi. Now, this is factual stuff. It's in all the ancient history books. Just because people don't know it doesn't make it any less true.
Okay.
Now, the fact of the matter is that the Arthurian tradition that came later, the Arthurian tradition is the first rescripting of the ancient Celtic legends. All the heroes in the King Arthur's court are actually based on, including Arthur himself, by the way, pre-Gaelic Irish kings. So the Arthurian legend is a carefully crafted and very interesting and semi-legitimate story. But But it is actually based on the goings-on in Ireland of a little bit previous age. And a lot of the prototypes that are used in the Arthurian legend and then enter into Judeo-Christianity are Gaelic in origin. People need to go to my website and find this out. It's most interesting, even
well,
the name.
Okay, well, it's, you know, it's all right. We're getting through it. So they had these wars with this hybrid race.
Right.
And they're making their way towards Sumeria, because this is pre-Sumeria, right?
Oh, this is all in Ireland. Yes.
Okay,
the word Sumeria is a Gaelic word, and it means the serpent.
So they're working their way. So how is it that these different races that we associate with Sumeria and Egypt, these Negroid races, come out of this Atlantean tribe?
These are the remnants of the old hybridized peoples. These hybridization, all the races that we know that have sprung into existence today are the motley crew, so to speak, all of these genetic experiments. Remember in my first book, I'm talking about the fact that the variable of the Earth changes was not something that was predicted by these experimenters?
Okay.
See, so we are dealing with the aftermath of something that even the experimenters and the warlike people who started this war, the ancient war of the gods in Atlantis and Lemuria, they did not know that war was going to devastate the Earth in such a way and spread the continents and destroy the Earth as they knew it. So when we're looking back at, from the pedestal of our times, back into ancient history, and this is what stumps a lot of people, they don't realize we are in the worst possible vantage point for looking back to think about the world. We are dealing with the world as the leftover of all of these races who all talk about the gods. I mean, you don't have to go to them. They're all telling you this story. But they are the remnants, the undereducated, ignorant, you know, scattered masses, bipolar in their biology, let alone their minds, trying to now live and make do in this atrocious aftermath of these cataclysms.
Well, here's another way of putting the question. When the remnants of this Atlantean culture worked its way from Ireland into the area of what we now know as Egypt and ancient Sumeria, were there tribes or civilizations there already?
Yes.
Okay.
But they were of the barbaric nature. They were of the nomadic, aboriginal, just like you see it today. These were individuals who were enlightened and incorporated and made good use of the civilizations there. For instance, the Phoenician race. It's known that the Phoenicians were the great maritimers of old. All the tin mines and copper mines that you find scattered on the coastlines of all European countries and even way into the east all have been recognized as the Phoenicians. In fact, all scholars recognize that the alphabet was created 7,000 years ago by the Phoenician letters. That's only partly true. What's more interesting to find out is that the Phoenicians are the Phoenicians or the Fenians of Ireland. This is not a cover-up. The Phoenicians were not this dark, swarthy, maritime, sort of a homeless race. It is known, for instance, the capital in the east of the Phoenicians was called Tyre, and they spell it conveniently T-Y-R-E. Tyre and Carthage are the two great cities of the Phoenicians. Well, Tyre is Tara. They've monkeyed around with the words so that you don't see it quite clearly. Tyre is just named after the Irish capital, Tara, because the Phoenicians with a P-H is really the Ph with a F. Phoenicians or the Fenians. To this day, Irish are called Fenian.
Ooh, yeah, that's right.
Right. Well, the Fenian are the original group who were these very much bold maritimers who came out of Ireland. It's only thousands of years later, after they had already then stayed in the Middle East a long time and married in, these are more in the historical ages, that we have the modern Phoenician that the historians point to as being this sort of a swarthy Easterner type.
Absolutely extraordinary. Once again, we are rewriting history on this program. We have to take a break. We're going to come back more with Michael Tazarian. His website is taroscopes.com. Stay tuned. Much more coming right up. Just a quick reminder, you are tuned to 104.4 FM. This is Resonance. My name is Rob Simone. The website for this program, which airs every Monday at 11:30 p.m., by the way, is www.robsimone.com. There you can find out all the information that you'll be wanting, contact info, past shows, upcoming guests, and a whole lot more. Let's get back to our guest right now, shall we? Welcome back to the program. Of course, Michael, we were just talking about this extraordinary odyssey of this Atlantean culture after the cataclysm that first made, well, at least some of them, made their home in what we now know as Ireland, and then went on to spawn the civilizations of ancient Sumeria and Egypt, and create these incredible civilizations and cultures and megalithic structures that I guess ultimately can be drawn back to the Atlantean civilization.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
Now, the Greeks never called themselves Greeks.
Ah.
Greek was a term that was given many years later by the Roman historians who were talking about the Hellenes. The Greeks referred to themselves as a Hellenic culture, Hellenes. Hellene means shining one. And that has to do with their physical features and also their level of enlightenment.
Okay.
And all the Hellenes, the highest or the most accepted tribe, were called the Pelasgians. Okay, so I'm throwing a lot of terms out here, and people, you know, can go to the website and see the whole structure of it. But the Hellenes themselves say that their first ancestors were two tribes, the Archaeans and the Pelasgians. And the Pelasgians are known to anthropologists and ancient historians. The Pelasgian ruins, these megaliths that exist in Greece, have been studied. They are identical to those in Ireland. So the fact is that, and they're not like any others. So the Pelasgian people and the Irish people are the same. The word Syria comes from the word for Druid. And it also comes from the word for Freemason. And Freemasons did not call themselves Freemasons. The word Mason, Freemasons in earlier centuries used to be called Ser, S-A-E-R, from which we get the modern word seer, right? The seers, those who have the knowledge, those who can see. But the word Ser actually referred to the Druids, the original seers. The word Syria means men of the West, or the colonized by the Western people. That's what the word means.
Wow.
The Medes, the Phoenicians, the Persians are Aryan in their ancestry. Did you know that?
I did not.
Oh, yeah. And so are the Babylonians, and so are the Egyptians. From a racial point of view and from a cultural, ethnic point of view, they're all Aryan in ancestry. This is irrefutable. All the encyclopedias accept that, except the ones that have been so tampered with. But getting more back to the point is, after these people had set up a decent civilization of earth-loving, knowledge-appreciating giants in the world of knowledge in Ireland and England, the great colleges there, it is from there that they then spread in exactly the same way as in the Christian era. And people only have to look at that movie, The Name of the Rose, to see what I'm talking about. It's well known that the Christian monks were itinerant, that they spread out through all of the world, all the Dominican and Franciscans, all used to travel to different parts of the world. Well, listen, that was late in the post-Christian era. Had not the Druids done the same thing? It's not preposterous. In fact, it's exactly how knowledge of any kind got to these far out levels of the world. Because when we're talking about civilization, we're not talking about indigenous people. Most indigenous people are not civilized. Civilization is a thing that is brought. It is an idiom. It is a thing that is brought to people by people who are civilized. It's not just something that morphs eventually down through time. It can happen, and of course now we're living in this completely mixed situation. So we have a different kind of history than the history of that happened in the rebirth of this planet after these enormous cataclysms. And my work is to follow on the American Barry Fell, one of the great unknown scholars of this country. Barry Fell was another man who discovered Celtic ruins, Celtic glyphs, Celtic writing in America. He is a man who questioned the Anasazi Indians. How come these Indians just come and they go? Well, you go there to the Indians in the local area, and they don't tell you that the Anasazi were dark-skinned Indians. They tell you that they were white, blonde-eyed guys from the West. Wow. But after they built their observatories there, up and left, and went back westward, back east. Now, modern scholars don't want anyone in this wide world to know that America was colonized by the Phoenician traders. Even though you have pictures of elephants down in South America, even though you have tobacco showing up in the coffins of the Egyptians where they said tobacco could never grow.
Well, you know what else they had in these Egyptian pharaohs? The Egyptian, Michael, not only did they have tobacco, but the Egyptian pharaohs had eucalyptus as part of their embalming process.
That's right. All things were never meant to grow in that area. So
And here's another one. Cocaine. A lot of them had cocaine in
cocaine mummies, exactly.
In their bloodstream.
Because your officialdom, all in a tizzy about all this, and yet so many people for years have been saying, look, of course these people had cultural dispersion. The word pharaoh comes from the word phara, which means God in Irish. The word for God in Ireland used to be called phara, and from which the pharaohs came.
So how does this strange hierarchy of the pharaohs evolve from this what seems to be a very cohesive society coming out of the Atlantean Empire? I mean, we have the pharaohs, and next thing you know, they are worshiping all these different gods. It seems as though they lose their way.
No, it's meant to look like that.
Ah.
The modern historians have rewritten the history so that you are meant to think that these were pantheistic maniacs who were in all sorts of pantheism, and they had thousands and thousands of gods. Nothing of the sort was true. First of all, excuse me, these were not very coherent places. Civilization was brought and disseminated from the West to these lands. The Egyptian pharaohs, you know, put it this way, King Menes of the first dynasty, the first king of the first dynasty of Egypt is called King Menes, but he happens to be buried in Londonderry.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Skota, who is Meretaten, who is the oldest daughter of Pharaoh Akhenaten and his wife Nefertiti. I mean, people have heard of Nefertiti and they've heard of Akhenaten. Well, they had six children. Their oldest child was a girl called Meretaten, who is also known as Scotia. She's buried in County Kerry in Ireland.
Good Lord.
Yeah. There was a pharaoh's daughter called Tia Tefi. She's buried in near Newgrange, near where the Boyne River is. Her tomb is there. It's been accepted. The prophet Jeremiah, according to Christian religion, is buried in Northern Ireland. And the list goes on. There are so many dignitaries from the East who, for some reason, according to Western historians, just before they died or for some other reason, embarked upon a boat and just decided to go to Ireland and to live there the rest of their lives and then to be died and to be buried there. Well, look, the true story is this, is that these people were just returning home.
Wow.
All Eastern people who are of the enlightened ones, the kings and the pharaohs, all knew that their original homeland had been Ireland, and some of these characters had just decided to go back. Scotia is the pharaoh's daughter who gave her name to Scotland. All people who understand the occult history of Scotland know that Scotia is the name of Scotland, came from a pharaoh's daughter's name. That's all accepted. That's a purely accepted fact. There's
and what about
alternative historians like ourselves? This is accepted
okay.
in the world.
And what about Nova Scotia?
Same thing.
Yeah.
Because it was the Scottish who went out there and named that. So we have a situation here. We have mummified baboons that have been found in Irish tombs. We have mention of Irish tombs in ancient Egyptian papyrus, that there was commerce between the two. We have letters going back and forward. We have similar kinds of buildings, and we certainly have similar kinds of theocracy. This is the most important part, because the physical remnants are interesting. Of course, the scientists all get interested in that. But my interest is more in the theocratic, philosophical, enlightenment type of interchange, that there was assimilation, and that we have druidic principles turning up in Judeo-Christianity that we're not aware of being druidic, because there's been a bill of goods sold to us. The fact that the beefeaters wear the red thread around their waist, that the royal family walk on the red thread, people point to all of those things as being Judaic in origin, you know, of Jeremiah and the line of Judah and all of these kinds of things. So my life work has been to correct all of this and show that, yes, they came by way of the house of Judah, and they became by way of the house of Israelites. But where did they get them? What is an Israelite?
Hmm.
What is a Jew? What do those words come from? You know, we have to go further back than the history that we've been taught. We've got to do two things. We've got to understand that there was a Western spread of civilization, like I've been saying. And then two, we've got to say, yes, there are many people from the Israelite community and from the Eastern community telling you that they are the ones who had all of these divine symbols and divine learning, but they omit to tell you where they came from, and this omission is most important. For instance, here's another anecdote. In Genesis 11, the Bible says, in those days there was but one language. Okay, they say that there was, in the beginning, was one language. Now, isn't it interesting to you, because it certainly is to me, that then in the next sentence, and in subsequent sentences, and in all the verses, and in all the chapters of the book of the Bible, they don't say that that one language was Hebrew? No rabbi says it, no Christian has ever said it, and the Bible doesn't say it.
No,
but it does say in Genesis 11.
I wouldn't have thought it would be.
Now, I've got a question.
Yeah.
If they omit to say that it was Hebrew, and by God, you can bet they wouldn't have omitted it if it was Hebrew, then what was it? Now, then we come to linguistics and find out that Gaelic is the parent language of not only Hebrew, but of Sanskrit. The Japanese Ainu language is closest in relationship is what? Gaelic.
Really?
Oh, yeah. All linguists know, and all etymologists and all philologists know, that the earliest languages on this planet, because the Phoenicians, they claim, created the Cadmean letters. The 16 letters that we use today of the 26 are meant to be Phoenician. But they hide the fact, as I said earlier, that the Phoenicians are really the Irish. Now, so, you know, omitting that they don't even admit this, they do admit, they do concede that the oldest languages in the world are Gaelic and Irish. I mean, so Gaelic and Sanskrit. However, in exactly the same way as they omit the, in the Bible to explain what was the one language, in the same way the linguists are particularly vague about which one of those two original languages was the parent of the other.
Huh.
Well, the answer is that Gaelic was the parent of Sanskrit. But see, they don't want to let you know that because then the whole cat is out of the bag. So what have they done for all these hundreds of years? They've just been vague about it. They will refuse to admit, and they claim that there's all these reasons why they can't decide which of the two languages. But the Brahmins of India will tell you that the round towers that were built in India before the Brahmins even came on the scene, that the Vedas, because the word Veda and the word Edda of Scandinavia are the same word, by the way, and the word Veda itself comes from the Gaelic word for the poet. Veda with an F, Veda, or the Fade, are the Celtic Gaelic poets who visited Ireland and created the lingo and the knowledge that came with the Vedas. If people don't believe that, then they need to go to any Hindu and ask them about what is called the Aryan invasion of the North. And all the Indian people in India, that's not people who write on India, these are the people in India, know that the north of India was always conquered by the Aryan race, a people that they called the Arya, who lived in a place called Bactria. Now people need to go to encyclopedia and put in the word Bactria, B-A-C-T-R-I-A, Bactria. It's northern India, it was like a paradisical place, which was always frequented by the high Aryans, who brought culture into India. And the Brahmin Vedic tradition is descended again from these Aryan invaders from the west, from the north. The northwest is where they're meant to have come from.
Huh.
The Veda and the Edda is the same word. The Dramatis Personae in the ancient Indian legends is the same Dramatis Personae as in the Scandinavian legends of their gods and their kings. This has all been proven, but it's been suppressed.
How much of a mixture is or was the existing civilizations of Sumeria, Mesopotamia and Egypt, and the other sort of civilizations that have made a mark on history, how much of a mix was it that we see today that is a result of what the original ideology of these Atlantean refugees had and maintained, and what ultimately came out as a hybrid of who they encountered?
Yeah.
And the ultimate sort of political and sociological effects on their religions.
Well, it's there, but it's in plain sight, which means it's invisible, but it's in plain sight. It's not that the individuals anymore, physical people, know any of this, what I'm talking about. It's in the idioms that they use. It's in the letters that they write.
Okay.
It's in the customs that they have. It's in the calendar festivals that they celebrate. It's in perhaps the way they dress, in the food they cook. It's in all these patterns that they just take for granted, and of course they believe are theirs. Nobody asks, oh, where did this particular religious rite come from? Or where did this particular phrase, political phrase come from? All these ancient, basically in short, well, the answer to your question is that it doesn't exist anymore. At least not the consciousness as we know it now. We are in such a mixed and basically what is called degenerate situation in the world, where man is so cut off from his roots. And don't you know that Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin and every other demagogue in this world from the Roman times onwards have always said that if you are successful to cut a man off from his ancestral roots, then you have a man who's able to be controlled. I mean, that is 101 of political, the architecture of control. Cut a man off from his roots and he is your puppet. We are all cut off from our roots. And then because of this insecurity, naturally, well-meaning people who want to then rediscover their roots.
Yeah.
Like the Aryans tried to do in a bad way in the 19th century, like African blacks have tried to do now and are still trying to do in a kind of a hopeless way, but I understand the reason. There's a knee-jerk need to reconnect those roots, but that's like, that's like a metaphor for that? That's like trying to glue an apple back on a tree. Once you pluck the apple, I'm afraid it can't be really put back on the tree.
You can't be
and
unplucked.
And that's kind of what has happened to us. The apple has been plucked, meaning
okay.
The true knowledge of the world.
Well, let me ask you this. This is the question I really wanted to ask.
Yeah.
What then, from your investigation, thorough investigation, very detailed look into all this minutia of these ancient texts, what is the original religion or belief system?
It was solar.
Solar.
Like Jordan Maxwell is really the expert on this, and it was through his influence that I had to ask the same question you just asked. It was stellar, meaning that it was of the heavens. It was an astrological canon. It was a Gnostic type of religion, a theocracy that is best called astrotheology. And that's why that even I present this kind of information, the minutia, I present it on a page called astrotheology, because that is the umbrella that you're looking for. That the religion of the ancient ones, and that includes the Japanese, and it includes the Brahmins, and it includes the Teutonic people.
Well, it's a major component in many belief systems.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
And look at the regalia of the flags. Look at the flags of the world.
Absolutely.
Look at the state buildings and how much stellar, and when I say stellar, for people who don't know that word.
So how did you characterize it?
Stellar.
A stellar religion.
Yeah, meaning of the heavens. Sidereal is another word that could be used.
Of the heavens. Now, what does of the heavens mean? That's a pretty
zodiac.
Broad. That's a pretty broad statement.
The zodiac. The original religion is nothing but a condensation of the study of the heavens. And with the understanding that the real zodiac is within consciousness. Now, people who are familiar with my work will know what I'm talking about. To other people, it's going to come as a bit of shock. They're going to have to do some homework. Go to my website, find out about
the
thing.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the study of the constellations somehow reflects our inner makeup?
Precisely.
How so?
That's a long story. We could never cover it in a short talk. I have an... if people go to the High Windows page of my website...
Let's talk about it in a way which would make sense.
Well, let's put it this way. There is deep symbiotic connection between the microcosm and the macrocosm, between what we call psychic energy, which is the energy that you think with.
Yeah.
Just because you're not plugged into a wall doesn't mean that you have no energy. The energy that is there in your body when you wake up, when you were born, is called libido by psychologists. This libido is not plugged in anywhere like a regular electronic thing is plugged into somewhere, but it is plugged in to the ether, to the world, to the universe, through these very strange metaphysical ties. But what the ancient Native American Indians understood, what the great shamans of old understood, and what the Druids understood, is that psychic energy, this thing that helps you wake up, that you think with, that you create your thoughts with, that you live your life with, and physical energy, like the sun burning and the earth moving, and the water's flowing, is connected. They're not separate. In fact, the idea that they are separate is a Mao idea, which is come into human beings after the genetic hybridization and the trauma to their system. After the great trauma to the system, and believe me, it was a massive trauma, so much so that just like people like Terence McKenna has said, it may have actually made the human race schizoid. Hmm. According to people like the great psychologist and his name is Julian Jaynes, the great people who've studied the brain and its growth through time. These people are believing that man is basically a schizoid creature. And very few of them, I think Jaynes does point to a cataclysm in the past. He's vague about it, but he says that some cataclysm in the past may have caused this trauma, this primal wound in the psyche of human beings.
So what you're saying is we've been disconnected
from
the source of the cosmic rhythms that we were supposed to be in touch with.
The natural order. And I believe, my work is always stressing, that it was the willful, deliberate, it was humanoid action. It was the pole shift and the floods that caused this trauma. Now, to carry on with your answering your question, this trauma, out of the trauma of consciousness was completely gone. I mean, the human being was in such a existentially distraught situation that the ego, what we now call ego, was created. The ego has a date of birth. I know this is kind of vague to a lot of people, but the thing that you think with and that rules your life, which is called the ego, has a date of birth. The ego, fragile as it is, awfully, you know, destructive as it is in this world, is the entity that came about almost like a spasm in a muscle, like when you're about to fall and your muscle sort of spasms to hold you up.
Right.
Think of the ego like that, only think of it as a muscle made out of energy.
Hmm.
The human ego came into existence to stop the whole human race going completely insane, which was happening in this world about 13,000 years ago. And we have this little ego now who's thinking, hey, it worked, so all you guys worship me. Ego is not consciousness, as Freud and Jung talked about. It's a part of consciousness. It's a very efficient part of consciousness. It's like the executive director in the corporation, for instance. But it's extremely authoritarian. It's extremely dictatorial. But my God, what would we have done without it?
Okay, so let me rephrase that for people who are scrambling to wrap their minds around it. It would seem that somewhere, somebody who sought power, who sought recognition, decided that he had an edge over a certain group of people and wanted to disconnect them from this magical harmony of the universe, this connectedness to the galaxy and the cosmos, by saying, forget about that, that's not the way to go. Bring your attention from the universe down to me. In other words, stop looking up, look at me now. I'm going to replace the heavens. This is the right way to go, and here's a book and some ritual to fill this void, which, of course, is very difficult to do. You're talking about filling the void of the universe, but is that kind of what went down?
You couldn't have said it more precisely. It is exactly like that, and the ego then is a big promiser. It's just like any politician. It goes, look, of course you don't have the symbiotic connection that you're familiar with. Of course you don't have that beautiful, nirvanic, umbilical connection to the universe. But see, when you did have that, it'll get destroyed, you chumps. So listen, I'll give you the same thing. It'll just take time. I'll rebuild all of that behind the scenes, you know, in the back lot, and you will have all of that, and we'll call it technology. Here, I will actually give you the same toys, the same power. You'll just have it in a bit of a different way.
It's interesting because,
masculine.
I mean, they must have, somebody must have realized that if they're connected to the cosmos, then there is no budget for churches. There is no hierarchy.
Right.
There is no sort of power or dominance over people. You can't have that unless you create something that is earthbound, that is on the plane of this material expectation. Do we have a starting point for who, when that first happened? Did that happen in Atlantis first?
No, it happened after the cataclysm. And this, what you're talking about, is David Icke always talks about the five senses is all we have reality. Exactly. This was a, see, I can understand the case of the ego. The ego has a mighty big case when you bring up these issues. It goes, look, you guys were running around like headless chickens. I am your savior. And all the representatives that I create and put in front of you, you will get down on your knees and you will worship them, and there will be no question, because you are renegade. You owe me your ass.
So it seems as though after this cataclysm, a lot of people's, or a certain amount of people's face was shaken.
All the world. The whole world. The descriptions of it are unbelievable.
So it left everyone vulnerable
to
questioning their belief in the cosmos, and they wanted something immediate. They wanted something that would be a pat on the back.
Well, they wanted sanity. They wanted actually, what we have is a semblance of sanity. It's like what you're saying. We don't really have the same thing anymore, and we certainly do not, except in some exceptional human beings who are still, you know, the Mozarts and Beethovens and Salvador Dalis, who may still have an old throwback remnant of that immense, immense connection to the real matrix. Well, the rest of us don't have that. The rest of us have ego. And ego is a chimera. Ego is a chameleon that can be all things to all people. It's the cosmic magician in the tarot cards that says, look, yeah, I know you don't have the real thing, but guess what? I can give you the illusion of the real thing. Don't you want to live in this sort of simulacra fantasy world that you have real? Now, most of us kind of know that we're in on this conjurer's trick. But see, we don't have the alternative. And you know something? As soon as you start to think about the alternative, you have a wave of trauma. And rightly so, because the time, it's like it's a defense mechanism. If your mind does in fact start to think about the other world or the pre-world or your state of consciousness before, you're met with fear, because that was the ancestral fear at the moment of changeover between this psychic hierarchy. When the ego took over, we were in a state of unbelievable trauma. So when you step out of the control zone of that the ego has prepared for you, this beautiful, nice, decorated little paddock, which you're not meant to go near the gate because it has an electric fence, and if you touch the electric fence, you're going to get a bloody shock. So most people stay within the consensus zone, saying, well, you know, it's not great, but my God, I have all these thoughts of disaster, and I see demons, and I have also schizophrenic, what we call schizophrenic or bipolar people who see all this weird stuff and the rhetoric. I don't want to get into the whole thing, but
they were looking for security, or they were looking for comfort or security.
These are individuals who've broken through the ego trance. Most schizophrenics are actually brilliant people. Most people who have bipolar disorder and all of these things are individuals who wouldn't accept, so they kept on holding on to the electric fence.
Yeah,
and the electric fence incinerated their mind. The ego said, "Then you are a renegade. You will be cast out." It's like they show in that movie Zardoz. You will become apathetic, or you will be not. You dare to question my authority and wonder what's on the other side of the wall. You know, it's like a Pink Floyd type situation.
Yeah, right on.
There must have been a door in the wall here when I came in.
Okay. Well, let's go back.
Representatives to you go. Wait. Hey,
let's go back to this again. Original connection that these Atlanteans had with the cosmos and the zodiac. In their belief system, what was their answer to a supreme being?
Well,
did their belief system contain that concept?
I don't get into that because I do not want to get to turn people off by their... See, I know that if I start mentioning my belief systems on that, then I am immediately putting myself in reaction to those who've got, you know, who are still in the consensus trance or who have a role situation. I don't want to get into it. My book doesn't get into it. It avoids the metaphysics of it. I've been actually even criticized for that. But there's a reason why I do that. It's because I want people to get into this knowledge objectively. I want them to come from whatever persuasion that they are coming from and investigate the facts without...
Let me roll it back then. So, again, I'm trying to get a sense of this original relationship that people had to the stars, to the galaxy. Now, what it sounds like you're saying is that there was no supreme being.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying anything. I'm being neutral about it because...
I'm reading into it then.
Okay.
So why is the fact that there was a God or no God such a hot topic? I mean, a lot of people are atheists.
Well,
a lot of people are agnostic. I mean, that's not a concept.
No, Rob, there is a God, but the God is the ego you've just been talking about. The ego has set itself up as the God. If you want the Gnostic truth, I'm a Gnostic, so I'm just going to hit you over the head with it. The ego is inflated because it did a job of work that was immense for the human race. In the throne, the empty throne, now you're asking what was on that empty throne before the ego put its ass there. I don't know. I'm not going to say, I have thoughts about it, but I'm not going to share those. All I'm concerned about right now is that this ego, the guy with the broken crown, who keeps putting the crown up and saying, hey, do I look all right? This ego that is in all of us is the ruler, the demiurge. The Gnostics call it Rex Mundi, the Lord of the World. And, you know, some people have even said that the Jehovah has aspects of this demiurgic quality. The fact of the matter is, cut out all the religious jive and just go back to the psychological truth of it. The psychologists have terms for all of this. The ego, the superego, the consciousness that we have, we are no longer connected, we're divided. That divided was not unnecessary, it was kind of necessary in a way, because if you divide something, you can control it. So the ego knew that in order to create a semblance of reality, I mean, it's like in that movie Pink Floyd, you know, The Wall. Remember after the guy goes through his utter chaotic breakdown, and then you see him putting together a mandala of all the little broken things that he's smashed up?
Yeah, Pink. Yeah.
Right, remember that?
Yeah.
That's exactly what the ego has done. The ego said, my God, look what you've left me. Look what consciousness is. You're going to tell me this is what consciousness... We were the most bipolar... Read Julian James, the top scientist. I mean, you can't get any higher on the totem pole than these people, and they have explained it. The consciousness was in ruins, unimaginable ruins, in exactly the same way that the Earth was in ruins. So it's like along comes the ego, like that guy Pink, and goes, okay, I guess we can make a new mandala, something quite sacred, actually. But it will be a polyglot of all the pieces of the amazing world that we have left, and which is fading, which is already fading from us. We don't even remember. It's vague. It's a dream. And then we put it together. What we have now is that incredible sand painting, that amazing Tibetan mandala, you know, which easily could blow away with the wind, and that's what might be coming in 2012, because it's an extremely fragile thing. And the end of the Age of Pisces and the coming of the 2012 zero hour is, I believe, the end of that sand painting. It's already been blown.
All right, well, let's talk about that, too. I mean, it's interesting to think that our consciousness, human beings or whatever they were back in Atlantis, these humans were so connected to the Earth, and that's, again, not unusual because there is a symbiotic harmonious relationship to any entity and the planet that it dwells upon.
Right.
And once there was this cataclysm, a physical Earth cataclysm, it's interesting that it had an instant and equal reaction in the consciousness of its inhabitants.
Of course, because it goes – remember, we still have certain people who are creative and even ordinary people. Everyone in this world has certain throwbacks. It's not that it's completely gone. It's just that under drugs or when you have a euphoric experience or an athlete who's won something or you fall in love, all that malarkey, you know, and all of these different what might be called the pheromones and the throwbacks, we all have it. And certain creative people have what they call the muse or the inspiration. So it's not completely gone. There is something that is anti-ego.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then, because you're the one to ask. If there was no cataclysm, where would – in your opinion, or just sort of maybe a general guess, would have the civilization been at? Where would they have ultimately perhaps evolved to?
Oh, unimaginable. We'd be in a golden age. We would have now what the ancient shamans of the Native American Indians were talking about, of this utter unbelievable rapport, this umbilical connection to the animals, to the flora and the fauna. There wouldn't be any slaughterhouses, and that would do me. Just to get rid of them, I'm happy in the world. I think the world would be fine right now if we could just get rid of those. But if your scenario would be, we would not only be mistreating animals, we'd be living in an indescribably brilliant place that nobody, not even, you know, nobody in literature could, who's got even the most incredible imagination. This reality is beyond even Tolkien. It's like Tolkien leaves you at the end of the Lord of the Rings. He doesn't really show you what the world is that they're going to build after, you know, the fall of the Dark Lord, because that's for your imagination. We would have kings that meant something to us. We would have king, comes from the word kin, kindred, your blood, a man or a woman who was literally so kindred to you, like the shamans of India, of the Native American Indians. We would have monarchs that we loved, who would die for us, who had total occult knowledge. All of us would realize that we were priests and priestesses. We wouldn't be overpopulating the world. We wouldn't be devastating the world. We would have such an immense connection to our inner core. I mean, the list goes on.
Yeah.
What the metaphysical and religious people are looking for. That's why I'm not against religion in certain senses.
Well, yeah.
Because I understand that the core of these religions is that utopian glow. It is that thing that we're all looking for.
Well, it seems as though our Achilles heel is our connectedness to this vulnerable planet. I mean, if there wasn't this cataclysm, it seems as though our evolution...
But don't let that be a cop-out, Rob. See, because my work is extraordinary, is idiosyncratic in that area. It's extraordinary in that area because I do not believe, like every other writer, that the event that caused these tribulations was just some straying comet that happened to act of God, freak of nature. I have linked it to an actual, same as the legends are telling us. It's nothing that I've made up. It's just I've read the legends and believe that these were humanistic. They were humanoid in nature. The cataclysms that we have suffered through, and that our ancient forefathers are suffered, and that are written in our own DNA, in our scriptorium, the fears that we have, the phobias that we have, the fear of the ocean, the fear of lonely places, of thunder in the sky, all the rest of it, of certain insects. All of these traumas are humanoid creation. It was through this belligerent war that happened about 13,000 years ago that inherited this. The Earth didn't go through any pole shifts.
Oh, so there wasn't a comet or a meteorite?
No. As you've read in my first book, this was humanoid nature.
Yeah, okay,
and
so...
this is what then caused the schism. Now, remember, the first trauma, let's get things really straight. The first trauma, we've been talking about the trauma to the ego and the human race.
Yeah.
The first trauma was the hybridization. It was the genetic interference. So long before the pole shift and the war of the gods, the very first trauma to the human being was already artificial. It was this Planet of the Apes type of experimentation that went on, and I believe in future ages they're going to absolutely prove this. They already know it. They're just not letting us know about the DNA. The incising and the crossing of alien DNA with our human aboriginal DNA was already enough to shatter the consciousness that our forefathers knew.
Yeah.
We've been talking about it with the cataclysms. It's just like the icing on the cake. Taken together, the hybridization, the trauma that causes to the original mind of our ancestors, who none of them exist anymore, all of us are hybridized, and then subsequently the awesome trauma of the Earth itself going through those cataclysms of the physical nature left the what we would want to call consciousness, in an absolutely torn and ripped and psychotic state.
My goodness.
From that psychotic state, in exactly the same way, I mean, it is a true simile. In the way that you prop yourself up and your body goes taut when you try to, you know, prevent yourself from falling, or you try to grab a glass off the table, there was a spasm in consciousness, collectively. And that spasm created the ego. I mean, the word ego is the word egg. It comes from the Latin egg, ego. And the egg split, and it's like this ego came out and said, I will save you. And that ego is still in spasm. That's why you can't talk to the ego. That's why the ego, spiritual people, gurus, anyone who's trying to deal with the ego, know it's a damn hard nut to crack. And the reason is because, yeah, it had to be. It's spasmed like that, and it's so defensive and materialistic and masculine is the true term. It's very, very masculine. It's very torpid and rigid, armored. Is because that's the ego. You can't make it into something it's not. I go into this in some of my articles. Don't try to make the ego into something that it's not. You owe that ego. You know, it may be like this office director, a real pain in the ass, and everybody hates it. But what would you do without that official director? Now, it's not the executive. The executive is spirit. But until the time that spirit wants to reassert itself in this universe and into the consciousness of human beings, we have the managing director. And you're going to take that managing director's order whether you like it or not, because it is the one that is created. Now, if you want to step out and be a hippie, there's the door. That's what the ego says. There's the door, guys. And that's what the 60s was. That's what happens to certain individuals today. That's what schizophrenia is. That's what all sorts of mental disorders are. There's a lot of nuance, but basically I'm being very general about it. But most people who cannot buy into the rigidity from childhood or down through their life either will become psychotic, They'll go on to drugs. They'll become hippies. They might even become a criminal, part of the criminal class. But you never totally step out of the aura of the ego. Even if you're outside the door, my mind goes to that scene in Beverly Hills Cop where they just throw the, what's his name?
Eddie Murphy
right out the window. I mean, you can have the representatives of the ego literally ditch you into the gutter, but you're never going to be totally free of it. You'll always have a remnant of it. Because the schizophrenia that happened to our forefathers is still, unfortunately, written in our own being. So even though the ego has glued things together pretty well, in some people it's not so glued, and they come unglued, and then you have the infusion of elements from the unconscious, which then causes these people terrible, terrible sorrow.
So could I say in a grossly superficial and kind of encapsulated way that the downfall of human first step was this alien hybridization, and the second step was this man-made cataclysm that perhaps resulted from it?
Yeah, absolutely. The two are connected. You know, the fall, the original fall of the Garden of Eden can be seen as the hybridization. I see it that way. I see the interference, which is illegal. It's like any illegal immigrant coming here and then trying to run the government.
So why weren't we protected from on high? Was there no great power that was looking after us?
No, because man is his own great power.
Ah.
Our power was interfered with. Now that, again, brings us over into the metaphysical issues. What I will say is this. There is an overarching power, obviously, a universal intelligence that made our lives and made the universe, and it's not plugged in anywhere, so you know that there's something there. However, we must never underestimate the adversarial nature of the colonizers, the visitors to this planet. This is what my work is, you know, fundamentally trying to get out to people, is the origins of evil.
Yeah.
I hear so many people, I love the work of Graham Hancock and David Icke and so many other people, but, you know, there's so much into this new age escapist, you know, oh, what was the big question, you know, and there's the question right in front of them. The question is, stop talking about heavens, Valhallas, and utopias, and start talking about the living hell that we're in, and the kind of injustices and sadism that we've inherited in this world. Let's find out its anatomy, and then we'll have some answers. And the answer is that we must focus on this question of evil, because it's in us in a soft way, and it is in the world. It's a living thing, and it's firing on all guns blazing situation right now. And we are its repository. We may have not inherited it, we may not have created it, but we are inherited it. It came from outside like a virus infecting a planet, but we now have it in our system. So the real question of life is whether or not we are going to get the chance to do that. Because here's the most interesting thing, Rob.
Okay.
The ego has another particular aspect to it. Like any human being, it can die. Its death is very long. It's like, you remember the Vedic ages, the Yugas?
Yeah.
The Yugas are always described as the age of a day in the life of the god Brahma, who is born, who lives, and then who dies. Well, who are they talking about? Brahma is the ego that has a life of millions and millions of days. Wow. But the fact of the matter is that he does die. Now, coming up to 2012 and the age of Pisces, the closing of the age of Pisces, which is what Jordan Maxwell has talked about a lot, and now we're all getting into this Vogue thing about the Mayan end date. In simple terms, because I've done a 13-hour DVD on that very subject, I mean, you know, one can get into it in a long way, but in very simple terms,
okay,
let's just think of it as that the ego has created, like Pink, he's created this incredible mandala, but, you know, that mandala is finite. It's not made of the same stuff as the universe is. It's an ego concoction.
It's a safety mechanism or a band-aid.
Yes. And it has a fail-safe. It might fade out. So there's cycles. In everything in this world, including the seasonal cycles, there is a cycle, a rhythm, a series of phases. So what we're looking at the coming of 2012, and this is, again, very much general and brief, is that we are ending one series of ego life. Ego is an old man now. It's like he's the hermit instead of the fool in the tarot. And he's waning down. So what the end of the age of Pisces is, and we all know that Pisces is the last sign of the zodiac, which verifies what I'm saying. All astrologers know that Pisces is the last sign of the zodiac. We are then finishing one massive zodiological or psychological, because there really is no difference. We're going to make a lot of progress in this world when we understand that there is no difference between the word zodiological and psychological. People need to get their heads around that. But back to our story. The idea is that one end cycle, Yuga, the end of one cog, is coming at 2012, and the sand painting, which is already pretty, you know, faint, because it's been blown significantly through the years, what's left of it is going to could be erased. This is one of the theories that we're thinking of, that man doesn't even get a chance to get it right, because ego himself is resigning his post for another incarnation.
Huh.
So we have to look into this. I know that's a bit Vedic and a bit to do with reincarnation and certain things, but, you know, I have to use the jargon. It's all just jargon. I have to use the jargon that I'm familiar with.
Sure, no, we're cool with that.
We are ending a cycle that the Maya talked about in which it might be that the gatekeepers come in and go, you're all fired. The corporation is done, or whatever you want, is sold.
Yeah.
And we're putting the lock on the gate, and you guys can just take off.
And what will replace this ego, this little sort of safety spare tire that we've been running on that's now almost out of tread?
That's a great metaphor. I don't know. It could be a Mercedes, or it could be a freaking rickshaw. I don't know what's coming next. Nobody does.
Well, we do know. Everything is available, as I like
to
say.
We know. How can we know, man? We're looking at the plate glass of the corporation.
No, because we are empowered. We are emboldened. We are in touch. We can open up a window to the universe. We are infinite beings with infinite potential.
Well, that's right. And yeah. This is the work that, you know, ultimately is what I'm trying to do.
So, I mean, if we put our minds to it, we think, right, the ego now, the age of the ego is now coming to an end. And I think that we will see another round of Earth changes. I think there's going to be a meteor or comet, but it's not going to hit the Earth. It's going to hit the moon. And when it hits the moon, it's going to knock the moon out of its very precise equilibrium orbit. And when that happens, it's going to throw the tidal wave off. It's going to throw the tidal patterns off. And when that happens, we're going to see incredible flooding and devastation and tsunamis. So, it's going to be the age of water. What's the first sign of the zodiac?
The first sign is Aries, fire.
Fire. Okay, I just took a stab in the dark there. But I think, to go back to it, I think we're going to see another round of Earth changes. And maybe that will be the thing that finally cuts the umbilical cord.
Could be.
You know, of the ego, or rather, you know, just throws the last pile of dirt on this grave.
Right, exactly.
And then,
you do have those two schools of thought. A lot of people are going to be rejoicing in it, and part of me also rejoices in it.
Right.
Because the status quo that we've been living in has been so terrible, and if you really want, you know, honest opinion, that any break of that status quo could be a fine thing.
It's a birth or a
death.
And
we have the other school that's, you know, immensely traumatized by it and can't, and is lost because of that.
Yeah, I wonder if it, you know, a lot of people like to think that it's going to be the ETs that show up and fill this void.
See, I mean, maybe you have that theory. You know, also what's interesting is I have been so not able to think about that theory because what has gained my attention,
yeah,
a little bit different gear,
okay,
is that because of the countdown to the finality of this phase, the power elite structure of the world, that means the, you know, government forces and the people behind them, of course they know about what we're talking about. They have their experts also know, and I believe that the Nephilim descendants of the Atlanteans also know that this massive change is coming, and they have an agenda too. So what we've been talking about is a general agenda for the whole human race. But see, we must never forget that the ones who have the control over the ship of state also are very aware of this coming ending date. And, you know, there's been talk of photon belts, and there's been talk of other constellational alignments that might precipitate these changes. I believe those are already happening. So don't you see the dark side, those ones who have been the most perverse henchmen of the ego, who've abused the status quo, who say, well, listen, if we've got an evil demiurge ruling the executive, but he lives up in his penthouse and doesn't, it's like that movie Free Jack, he's up there, hey, we're the petty ones, but we'll go and lord it over everybody else and keep everybody in a state of servitude to us, and he won't know anything about it. And he might even be endorsing it, for goodness sake. So all these degenerates who run the system of the world, the perverse ones that we all know about and are finding out about, these world controllers might have a lot to fear by the selling out of the business, because they're now going to be on the streets with the rest of us. So there's a certain situation in which they are threatened. And my focus has been on what might their possible reactions be. I see a lot of strange rituals taking place in the Middle East. I see a lot of this connection to the invasion of Iraq, you see. There's a lot of different saber rattling going on right now, including some very bizarre rituals. If people get onto my blog, and you can get to the blog through the Taroscope's website, you'll see that if you go to the section on 2012, there's a link to a very strange, totally bizarre ritual that was done by the American troops out in Babylon, in which they made the symbol of a gigantic, and you could only see it from the air, a feathered serpent.
Really?
We talk about in the book the meaning of the serpent.
Well, I mean, where does this information come from?
This just happened, Rob, on April 16th. Maybe your show can cover it.
Well, I mean, what's the source?
The source is, it's called, it's, what does it mean, .com? Go there.
Oh, another website? I mean, did they get it from any established news outlet?
Yes.
It's been covered.
It's on my blog.
Since we're talking about it now, and was there any significant information that was imparted, or was it just some photograph that somebody saw?
No, this is military people leaking it, the people who were involved in the ritual. Some woman from a military who participated in this, because they were a Christian or whatever, was like completely spare over this, going, what in the hell is this? And it's not only one, there's been many. There's been many rituals.
Well, yeah, we can imagine, huh?
Yeah, many things going on. And this specific one, you see, they know about constellational alignments, and you're going to see more. You think this is the only one? Just keep your eyes open. From now to the next 7 years, there's going to be the most bizarre, this whole thing with this Bush going around to all these sacred sites, having his hand shake in front of in Mexico there, Clinton having his hand shook down in front of the Mayan calendar when he was in power. All of these politicians go to certain sacred sites, to Palenque, because they're waving to you. They're waving symbolically. These people never tell you what's happening in words.
What do you think is going to happen with Iran?
It's all fear. There's sacred sites in Iran that they want. There's burial sites of the Nephilim. This is my thesis. That the ancient Nephilim. Remember how we've been talking about the original visitors to this planet?
Yes.
With the assumption that they're dead, that it's only the descendants are left.
Okay.
Well, as I left off in the Atlantis book having people think that. In the DVD I do on Atlantis and on 2012, I bring up a much more occult controversial theory, which is that some of the original Nephilim, this is the full-blooded alien, no human blood at all.
These are the guys that were referenced in Genesis 5.
The same characters have been interned in certain places on the earth and are still alive. They're really the undead. It's where the whole concept of the vampire comes from.
Really?
And that some of these leaders, because the leaders of the world, these lower henchmen, have not been able to find out how they're going to save their ass when the great cleansing comes in 2012, when there's these changes in consciousness, they have been so desperate to find the answer for many, many millennia now, not just the last 10 years. They've been looking for the remedy of how to offset some of these cleansing patterns that Mother Nature is bringing in, which is going to deal with them. They're not able to handle this. So in last resort, so to speak, they're actually going to disinter, because they know where these ancient grave sites are. It's like some sort of X-Files thing, I know, it sounds like that. But it's an old occult agenda that has been spoken of in the ancient books, that these gods are interned in the earth. That's what they talk about in the Book of Revelation when they say that the giants are chained to the earth for 1,000 years or a period.
Okay.
Under the earth, in Iran, in Iraq, and in Ireland, and in Palestine, and in certain other places in the world, in undefinable places, but they know where these places are because they have the ancient maps. The Vatican people have kept these maps. Now, with the use of satellite, they're going to pinpoint these grave sites, these underground mausoleums, you know, just like you see in the movie Hellboy, and a lot of these movies that they're also revealing, Fifth Element. Watch what the movies are telling you, because they're accurate. They're telling you in symbolic.
So the thinking is that they're going to go to these locations and release them?
They're already there. But you see, in Iraq, they couldn't be doing it with Saddam Hussein and a civilized country overlooking their shoulders. I mean, this is an X-Files type of experiment, but even with permission, they did not want to go in there with their tents and their laboratories and their experts with the Iraqi spies and Saddam looking over their shoulders. So they had a better idea.
What group of people, what secret society do you think oversees these operations?
This is there's many names. You know, one can use lots of different names. It's basically the Freemasons, the Masonic Order, or the preservers of this knowledge.
Okay. So do we have any idea as to what happens when these ancient tombs are opened?
Oh, yeah. And it's not good, but that's a bit of a separate question. What's going on is that these individuals are in an undead state.
Right.
And they've been buried in certain places in tombs that are specially designed. And not the same way that you know about the pharaohs, but with crystalline technology. So these beings are truly vampiristic. They've been fed of all the pain and sorrow and death and murder and mayhem and wars of the world. All that fear, all of the tribulation from serial killings, from the violence that you have in your own family, from the violence that leaks off of you and the fear when you watch TV, to the world wars, all of it, taken in one, only generates one emotion, or two emotions, fear and anger and pain, right?
So it sustains them.
Individuals feed off of that through the earth grid.
So they're still alive down there, and each one is kept in a separate sort of tomb?
I don't know if they're separate, but there may be more than one in one tomb, I'm not sure. All I know is that these individuals, the legends say, are interned, and that they feed off what their henchmen do on the surface, which is that they create wars and mayhem so that they are fed by fear. These individuals.
So I wonder if they are overshadowing or if they are controlling certain key people on the Earth's surface. They are.
Yes. so the four Nephilim individuals who have taken over after they were interred have these secrets. And these individuals orchestrate the chaos in the world by design so that, one, their vampiristic leaders are fed with this energy, because we don't know a lot about human energy and the leaking from the brain. Another thing that they do, just as an aside, but a very important one, is that they often schedule mass events, like everybody charging down to Stonehenge to look at some crop circle, for instance, or looking at an eclipse. They stage this stuff because the human brain is an incredible generator. And we have around this Earth, all feng shui and geomantist people know that there's a dodecahedron, an Earth grid. And through this Earth grid that is linked to everybody and everybody's thoughts, all your thoughts and your fears and your, you know, pain and the death of all the ritual deaths and world wars that are still going on, all of this pours, just like Richard Hoagland has discovered, that all the atom bomb detonations, the banks, the stately homes, they're all in the 30th, between the 30th and 33rd meridian of the Earth. There's a reason why civilization and many of these banks and world events take place on a certain area of the Earth. In my book Atlantis, there's a whole chapter on this. Now, this is because of the Earth grid, because they want the energy to channel in to the limbic psyche of these underworld beings that are created there, just like the movie Underworld and other movies have shown.
Okay, now, so what you're saying is that the energy now, the milk is starting to sour, and there's less and less fear for these people to generate. And what's the plan? They're gonna release them and then?
Oh, no, there's more fear. It's just that they don't want to disinter them. They've had to because they have an overarching agenda, which is the coming of the end of the age of Pisces, or this Mayan end date, which could deal with photonic action. It might deal with some major earth cleansing. I haven't really thought about it, what the mechanics of it is, because that's not important to me.
Yeah, but all I know is that what's Mother Nature. What's the role of the Nephilim now, or in the near future?
Pardon?
What's the role going to be of the Nephilim once they are released?
Well, you see, we don't know what's going to happen when they're released. They might be as insane as hell and start devouring the very people that have disinterred them. They might not be happy. You know, they may not be happy after 11,000 years being dug up by their chumps who go, hey, boss, I think, you know, we kind of blew it. Can you give us some guidelines? They may be not happy, saying, you mean to tell me that 11,000 years have elapsed, you've controlled the world, you've raped every nation, you have everybody under servitude, and you can't find a way to offset this particular, you know, natural organic change that's taking place, and you wake me up. They may not be in a good mood.
That's
like
true.
This, that way.
Never, you know, and people get grumpy after 11,000 years of
sleeping. I know, and especially when they want feeding.
My belief,
and I talk about this in the DVD, that the ritual death of all the people in Iraq, all the mass murder that's been taking place there under the name of war, isn't it true that when any creature first breaks from an egg, what is the first thing that it needs to do?
It needs to clean up.
No, it needs to eat.
Oh, right, that too.
Right, all species, when you see it breaking from the egg, the first thing it needs to do is feed. In fact, it eats its own egg, often, right?
Well, yeah, it has a bite of, it has something going on there.
Right, so I believe that prior to the point where they're going to try and awaken this, part of the ritual involves a massive ritual death on site.
Right, they're going to have some minions there for them to feed on.
That's what they've been doing. The mass murder that's been taking place in Iraq has got nothing to do with America being threatened, 11, or oil, or Cheney having a bad day. No.
What about the hundreds of kids that go missing every year?
Same thing. That's another thing I'm very tied into. The whole story of ritual death, and that's so horrific we don't even want to get into it. I'll leave the experts, but, you know, my work also involves in Atlantis, in the DVD that's coming out in Atlantis, 15 hours long, we go into the whole story of the Nephilim and their internment and what's been really going on in this planet.
This is especially
by way of the Earth grid. People need to get into geomancy and feng shui and realize that even the emotions that you leak when you turn on the news is for them. The news is a picture show that they show you in order to continue to have you come out of your center, come out of your spirit body, and start leaking fear, just like David Icke has said many times, start, you know, leaking all these negative emotions so that they have a nice feed, a nice hors d'oeuvre.
Okay, so here's kind of the last question that it says in Genesis, the story of Noah, when it talks about the Nephilim, that they were on Earth and they mated with certain women. Are the offspring and lineage of these inter-species mixtures still on Earth, and these are the ones that are in power today?
Precisely right. This is what David has exposed. We're all exposing this now. Some of the bloodline books that came out before hinted at it. But definitely David and...
Are these the bloodlines of the Illuminati?
You got it.
Yeah?
Yeah, no question about it. This is what we exposed, that these people, the royal families, have kept meticulous bloodlines of going back through the Hanoverian line we were talking about.
Well, that would also imply that these royal families and who else is part of this bloodline are also part vampire.
Of course they are.
Now, does that mean that they feed on human blood?
Well, that's the part I don't... I wouldn't put it past them, let me put it that way.
Okay.
But I certainly know they feed on human negative energy.
I'll
go so far as to say that.
But so we're just unclear about their particular dietary...
Yeah, exactly.
Requirements.
Exactly. It's whether it's the hors d'oeuvre, or whether it's a snack, or whether it's like... Basically, they're feeding on the human race, period.
I understand.
The fact that they haven't started eating their bodies is a minor point. And they may even be doing that. I mean, I don't put it past...
Extraordinary.
Them. Crime, to me, is less about that.
Yeah.
As about putting the whole human race up as a blood ritual, so they can find from these extraterrestrial, or actually pan-dimensional entities, the key to getting off this planet. Because the key is that they've been interred on this planet.
Yeah.
And they can't get off, and in thousands of years, almost 11,000 years or more, they have not found a way to do it.
Yeah.
So they're actually doing... See, this strategy that we're talking about of them unearthing the Nephilim is not something on their agenda. They do not want to do it.
Yeah.
They're having to do it because time is getting short for them.
Yeah, well, time is also getting short for us. You've got a new DVD out.
A whole set. Six series.
Six series set. Good heavens.
22 DVDs in all. It's six box sets.
Bloody hell.
People can go to my website. They have their own website, Rob. It's originsandoracles.com. Or you can get to it by way of Tarascopes, but it has their own website, originsandoracles.com.
Okay.
They'll be released. The release date is the 27th of April.
All right.
We will be releasing those to the public. It's been 2 years in the making.
Yep.
They're wonderful. Wonderful project
well,
there.
I
not edited
you,
for time or content.
I wish you well on those. And, of course, you do have this new book coming out soon about the...
Irish origins of civilization. The previews to the book are on my Tarascopes website under the astrotheology pages. So if people are interested in that thesis, they can go to the astrotheology pages on the Tarascopes website. But the book itself will be out in late summer. We have the wonderful artist Jim Fitzpatrick from Ireland doing the cover art. You know, really wonderful. It's going to be a very great project.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Michael, once again, it has been an extraordinary show. We covered more on this program than some people do in a lifetime.
I know it, and that's why I love to come on. So I hope to see you at Conspiracy Con, too. I know that... are you going to be at Conspiracy Con?
Absolutely. I'm going to be there with some of the other speakers. It's always, always an incredible event.
Yeah, let's have a lot of people come and support Conspiracy Con. The information's on my website, or you can go to conspiracycon.com. for Brian Hall's wonderful, one-of-a-kind, get-togethers of the great intelligences so that people can find out what is going on.
Absolutely. If people liked the content of this interview, they will like to come there because they get more of it. They get information about some of the conspiracies that's related to economics and theology and politics and so much more. It is really the invisible college. Michael Dazarian, thank you so much.
You're welcome, my friend.
Well, that about does it for today's show. I'd like to thank Michael Dazarian for coming on and for everyone listening. This one was a real paradigm shifter. If you want information about past shows, we have two box sets, 10 CDs each, now available of the best shows we've ever done. And more information, of course, about that and about upcoming programs at our brand new website. It's been completely redesigned. It's all at robsimone.com. There you can find out all the things from which we are relating to you. Thank you so much for tuning in. Keep it tuned to Resonance FM. We will see you next Monday, 11:30 p.m. in the evening. And when the pubs close, the minds open. Cheers.